Welcome back to the second episode of our series on the Crusades with Nicholas Morton, professor in Middle Eastern history at Nottingham Trent University. If you haven't checked out the first episode yet, it is absolutely obligatory listening. So please drop everything, abandon your family and friends, and put the episode on immediately. But if you have, you will have known that we have concluded the story with a pretty unbelievable outcome, and that is the conquest of Jerusalem by the forces of the First Crusade. Professor, the often repeated line about the conquest of Jerusalem is that once they conquered it, the Crusaders were wallowing in blood in the streets of the city because they slaughtered so many inhabitants who were living there. How brutal were these massacres really, and why did they happen in the first place?
Yes, so the massacre in Jerusalem is not, in fact, the only massacre conducted by the Crusaders. There were several others. When they conquered Antioch to the north, they massacred the population there and in other towns, such as the Syrian town of Mara as well. And Jerusalem seems to have been particularly violent, and several thousand people were slaughtered in the Crusaders' initial conquest of the city, with other groups then being killed over the following days. So this was an extremely violent and bloody section of the Crusade. But as you say, it raises the question of why. What was the reason for this? Now, historians have given different explanations for the massacres in Jerusalem and elsewhere. One explanation is that this was standard military practice. So to a medieval eye, and this crosses many cultures, if a city surrenders when an army advances against it, the advancing army is expected to spare the inhabitants. If a city does not surrender, but resists an advancing army and is then taken by storm, then according to medieval military practice, it's considered to be understandable that the army will sack the city.
I was under the impression, that only the Mongols did that, and that's why they became infamous. That, you know, they asked, like, are you surrendering? They didn't surrender, and then they just massacred everybody. And that fact actually shocked people who were writing about it at the time, because they actually did carry out what they say that they're going to do. I didn't know that this applied, like, kind of wholesale in medieval warfare.
It can vary a little bit, but it is also common practice.
Right.
So that's one possible explanation, and that may explain some of the other massacres conducted by the Crusade, but I've always found that to be an unsatisfactory explanation for the massacre at Jerusalem, because they don't just conduct one massacre, they conduct several, and even the Crusaders themselves describe it as being extremely bloody. So we're looking at something that goes beyond normal military practice. And so it's difficult to explain, but I suspect that it probably sits somewhere in the following, which is that they've been marching on Jerusalem for years. It's taken them about 2 years to get to Jerusalem. By the time they get to Jerusalem, about 75% of all crusading forces who set out for Jerusalem have gone, either death or desertion. So the number of casualties among the crusading army has been enormous. So they've lost huge numbers of people. They've also suffered malnutrition, dehydration, and then they reach at their goal in Jerusalem. They're also obviously extremely ideologically charged. They're doing this to achieve a religious goal. And I suspect that once they cross the walls in Jerusalem, it's a little bit like blowing up a dam. The flood water just floods out, and we're looking at an enormous outpouring of a mixture of suffering and loss and religious fanaticism all being brought together in a colossal outpouring of violence.
What are they saying about it? You did say that they mention how brutal these massacres were. Are they justifying it in any way, or are they just like reporting the facts on what they did?
They don't see it. Well, it's complicated, but most crusaders don't see it as being a problem. We have some who seem to indicate that they felt some concerns at the sheer scale of the massacre. But from their perspective, Jerusalem is their goal, and they want to fully restore Jerusalem to being a Christian city as it had been many centuries previously. And so for that purpose, they want to massacre the population and thereby reclaim it. It's an exceptionally tragic and brutal event.
Professor, I mean, Jerusalem has fallen, but it just seems very unlikely that this kind of motley crew of an army whipped up from many different factions and places, fighting on unfamiliar terrain most of the time in an unfamiliar climate, and dealing with so many unknowns, would actually succeed in the end. And now you also said that they lose 75% of their forces as well. Okay, and yet they did succeed. It's like dropping an army on Mars and hoping they're going to achieve anything there. To what do you attribute the success of the First Crusade? You did mention morale before, but there must have been more, right?
Yeah, it really, really shouldn't have worked. It really shouldn't. And people have described Urban as launching the crusade, but in many ways, it was an enormous act of, from a purely military and practical perspective, it's hard to imagine the Pope ever believing this could ever work, because let's just acknowledge the challenge. They've got to march from Western Europe to Jerusalem. And we have reports of crusaders getting halfway through Germany and saying, okay, we've been marching for weeks. Where's Jerusalem then? They have no idea where they're going.
Yeah.
There's no formal command structure. Large numbers of the crusaders are non-combatants. They're just pilgrims going to Jerusalem. And so they've got to be fed and protected whilst offering nothing in return from a military perspective. They are going up against the Seljuk Turkish Empire, which is arguably the most effective and most elite empire and with extraordinarily competent armies of its era. And they're doing it with no logistics, really, or very, very light logistics. And this is a time when nomadic armies were, of their very nature, more effective than agricultural armies like those raised by the Crusaders. So it really, really shouldn't have worked. The factors that caused it to work, in my view, are firstly that some of their leaders were very, very competent. People like Bohemond of Taranto, a southern Norman conqueror, very experienced. And so he managed to work out ways of conducting battles that could, to some extent, offset the disadvantages of his own armies. There are groups in the Middle East willing to work with the Crusaders and support them. And that also is important. The Byzantine Empire is the obvious example, but there are also several Eastern Christian groups, particularly many Armenian societies, who have suffered under the Seljuk Turks and are willing to provide some support for the Crusaders. There are also some Bedouin and Arab groups that also support the Crusaders. I suspect they probably were being driven off their grazing grounds by the Turks, who of course are nomadic. But that's a little bit of a guess. But there are Muslim allies for the First Crusade. And until the siege of Jerusalem, the Fatimid Empire, that's a Shia Muslim empire centered on Egypt. The Fatimids wanted to resist the Seljuk Turks, who controlled much of the Middle East. And they too, for much of the Crusade's course, were prepared to ally with the Crusades. They do have allies. But even so, it still requires a fair amount of explanation. I think there's also ideological factors, religious commitment, the fact they've got no way of returning home where it's going to be very difficult, so they can't escape easily. And then, of course, as they start winning battles, they become more experienced, better able to work together, their troops become more competent, their skills improve. And once you've begun to win the first battle, you become better able to win the second battle. Once you've won the fifth battle, then you're going to be winning whatever happens because you're just that effective in combat.
So they did learn pretty quickly.
They learned a lot. and they're very, very interested in the warcraft of their opponents. There's a real focus on that in the reports written by the Crusaders. They want to understand how the armies raised by the Seljuk Turks or by the Fatimid Empire in Egypt, how those armies operate. Because obviously they're looking for weak spots. So, for example, they discover that the Seljuk Turkish armies, which are mostly made up of mounted archers, they work out the Seljuk Turks' bows, the bowstrings. They become weak and they begin to stretch in the rain. So if they get moisture, they stretch.
Mm.
And so the lesson from that for the Crusaders is fight in the rain.
What kind of a shock did the conquest of Jerusalem cause in the Muslim world?
It causes a substantial shock. Of course, before the Crusaders' arrival, Jerusalem had been besieged many times. Jerusalem had been on the frontier of war between the Seljuk Turkish Empire and the Fatimid Empire. And in, I think it was 1078, there was another very brutal massacre in Jerusalem, conducted by the Turks. So Jerusalem is already a war zone, and the city itself has suffered a great deal. But the sudden and unexpected arrival of the Crusade, and particularly this is a Christian invasion army, that is a major shock because, of course, Jerusalem thereafter is in Christian rather than Muslim hands. So that does seem to have caused a fair amount of shock. Although it is difficult to gauge, we do have some reports close to when the actual siege of Jerusalem expressing shock. Although many of the descriptions we have of the Crusader siege of Jerusalem come from many decades later. And so it's difficult to know exactly how people responded at the time.
Okay, so the First Crusade establishes the Kingdom of Jerusalem for the next about 200 years, right? Yes. What's the relationship between the papacy as well as the European aristocracy and this new kind of strange hybrid state in the Middle East? For example, did the king of the Kingdom of Jerusalem have equal status as a French king, for example?
Okay, so in the wake of the Crusaders' conquest of Edessa in the north, Antioch to the southwest of Edessa, and then further south, Jerusalem, you have the creation of a network of Crusader states, as they become known. So a series of Christian states or Catholic Christian states in the Middle East. And then a few years later, the conquest of the city of Tripoli in what today would be northern Lebanon creates the fourth Crusader state. And as you say, they survive for almost 200 years. Now, Jerusalem has a king, Edessa and Tripoli have counts, Antioch has a prince, but they all have rulers, and all those rulers depend to some degree on the Catholic Church. And
so it's not all one kingdom?
No, there's four.
I see.
When they conquer Cyprus in the 1190s, there's five.
Right.
But all these states, they're incredibly vulnerable in their early years, because in the wake of the First Crusade, most of the Crusaders go home. And that leaves only a few hundred knights in each state to continue to govern in that area. And so from their very early years, the Crusader states need thousands of pilgrims, settlers, and Crusaders every year to build their numbers and to make their states viable in the long term. And the papacy plays a crucial role in supporting this. Now, the kings of Jerusalem, as kings, they are technically equal in status to the kings of France or the kings of England or other places in Western Europe, although their territories early on are much smaller. But the papacy provides support by authorizing further crusades. There are lots of crusades in the years after the First Crusade. In fact, it's commonly known the Crusades were numbered. First Crusade, Second Crusade, Third Crusade, Fourth Crusade, etc. Those numbers, we do still use them, but actually it's quite misleading because between the First Crusade and the Second Crusade, there's many, many crusading armies that are sent out from Western Christendom. The numbered crusades are just the big ones, basically. So every year, thousands and thousands of warriors and families arrive in the Crusader states looking to expand or secure the Crusader states in their early years. And the papacy supports this, authorizing crusaders. And then 20 years after the First Crusade, or a little bit more, it's 28 years, in fact, after the First Crusade, the papacy also 29, I'm getting mixed up now, it's 30 years, apologies. 30 years after the First Crusade, the papacy also authorizes a formal institution, a monastic institution of the Catholic Church, which is the Knights Templar. And the Knights Templar themselves then augment the warriors defending the Crusader states, building, garrisoning castles, providing troops, and they are supported in large part by the papacy and other military orders, as they're known, Knights Hospitaller, the Teutonic Knights, a German military order later on. Some small Spanish military orders also have a presence in the Middle East as well. They also show the papacy's commitment to supporting the Crusader states, their expansion over time.
Okay, by the way, speaking of Kingdom of Jerusalem, the famous film depicting it is, of course, Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven.
Yes.
With the extremely beautiful, if a bit dull, Orlando Bloom in the lead role. did you see the film? And if you did, what did you think of it?
Oh dear. I have significant problems with it, I'm afraid. Just for a start, if I don't know if any listeners have actually been to that part of the Middle East themselves, they will know that this is not a landscape of deserts and palm trees. It's agricultural land. The Kingdom of Jerusalem, for the most part, is built on good agricultural land. In their early years, the Crusaders, they focus their attention on areas they can farm because they want to eat. And in fact, one of the ways I explain many of the Crusaders' early campaigns to my students is to show them a picture of a rainfall diagram of the Middle East. And I basically say, all you've got to do is follow the 1500 milliliter line of rainfall, and that's where they're attacking, because that's the farmland. And yet, in the Kingdom of Heaven, it's all desert.
Desert, yeah.
And perhaps rather sort of curiously, Orlando Bloom teaches people in the Middle East about irrigation, which seems rather unlikely to me, quite honestly, given that he's coming from an area with excellent rainfall, and in the Middle East, they're already experts at irrigation. But that's only a small point, but don't get me started too much on this one. We'll be here all day.
Okay. What about the battles? Last question. That are depicted in the movie and stuff.
The battles are a bit better. Okay. I like the way they show the fluid and organic movement of the Muslim forces in the battles. That works better, particularly in sort of field encounters. The Siege of Jerusalem is more problematic because Saladin's forces of this era hardly ever used siege towers, and they didn't use them at the Siege of Jerusalem. Saladin's tactics, like many other Muslim or Turkish or Kurdish commanders from his era, they almost inevitably rely on a massive archery and catapult barrage followed by undermining. They dig under the walls and then bring them down. They don't use siege towers. It's very, very rare. And they didn't use them at Jerusalem.
Saladin in the movie is a pretty cool character. I got to say that.
I like the actor. I think the actor does a very good job.
Very charismatic, opposed to Orlando Bloom, who's a bit lacking in this department, I'm afraid. But okay.
Yeah, there are very few characters. In fact, one of the few clips I have shown my students in the past.
There we go. Yes.
I don't do this much, but one of the things I particularly like, I like both the sentiment and the way it's delivered in Kingdom of Heaven, is where the Orlando Bloom's character says to Saladin, "What is Jerusalem worth?" And Saladin says, nothing. And then everything. And he's quite right. Jerusalem is valueless. It's not a large city. It's a small city. It has no major trade routes going through it. The big cities in the area are Damascus, Aleppo, and Cairo. People aren't interested in Jerusalem. It has no mining, very little agriculture. It's not a major market. It's valueless. It's a small city on the edge of the desert, which doesn't have a consistent water supply in this era. There's very little reason to want it. But it's Jerusalem. And it's central, of course, to Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. And so I like that sentiment because it captures the nothing and the everything. So that's one of the bits I do like.
Yeah, that's probably the best scene in the movie. And also the way the actor delivers it is just...
It's very well delivered, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, the military orders, you just mentioned them, most famously the Knight Templars, somehow the ultimate villains in Kingdom of Heaven, spring up as a result of the Crusades. Theologically speaking, how is it possible to take religious vows, which they had to do, and which are quite a serious thing, and yet be allowed to hack away with their swords and kill people at the same time?
Great question. So there's a couple of points here. The first, just to sort of start with the whole question of how they could do this. So the first crusade took place, 1095 to 1099, and it achieved its goals, astonishingly. But of course, that's not just a military fact. Many people at this time also saw this as a spiritual fact. If God hadn't supported the Crusaders, how could it possibly have succeeded? And so the Crusade itself, in the eyes of medieval thinkers, becomes an argument in favor of religious war. If God hadn't wanted it to work, it wouldn't have worked, but it did work. So that line in the sand has already been crossed, and holy war is already deemed to be acceptable in the eyes of the Catholic Church at this time. So it's less of a problem for the Templars to adopt a military role because that's already happened. And there's various writers who write in favour of the Knights Templar, making the same kinds of arguments that were made about the Crusaders in some respects, which is that the Knights Templar are the sort of the ultimate warriors of Christendom, because as monks through prayer, they fight the devil, but as warriors in the world, they fight the enemies of Christendom. They're sort of fighting on both planes, the ultimate warrior. And there's the head of the Cistercian monastic order actually holds the Templars up as role models for society. People should aspire to be the Knights Templar, particularly the knightly families of this era. So they're seen as something to celebrate. There are critics of the Templars. There's one very famous one, or I find him very interesting, from a few years after the Templars' creation, who makes the rather sarcastic or wry comment that the Templars' behaviour doesn't really match the behaviour of Jesus and his disciples. But he's a lone voice. There's not a lot of criticism that's been made about this. So, yes, the Templars are seen as being a sort of institutionalized form of religious warfare. And you could also point out that the monks or monastic virtues of poverty, chastity, and obedience, they do actually, again, lay the foundations for an effective military force. If you have a group of people who are rigidly loyal to their superiors, who perform their instructions exactly, that has a military application. If you have a society where people live in poverty with good food, but with no sort of additional money or no additional sort of trinkets or wealth, that when they fight a battle, where other knights might defeat an enemy and then start gathering all the gold and looting their armor, Knights Templar won't. They will charge, defeat one unit, turn, charge again, defeat another unit, turn, charge again. They will continue to fight. They won't be distracted by the allure of gathering plunder. They'll just carry on fighting. And because they are rigidly trained, again, the monastic system, the system of monasteries, can facilitate that because training is part of a monk's life. So Knights Templar train all the time. They're very disciplined, they're very organized, and therefore they are a fearsome force on the battlefield. But if I could also answer your second question, and this takes us back to Kingdom of Heaven, because you're right. In Kingdom of Heaven, the Templars are presented as the ultimate fanatics. But this is, again, is fairly misleading. And I'll tell you a story. One of my favorite sources from the history of the Crusades was written by an Arab nobleman called Usama ibn Munkit. And he was in the service of the Emir of Damascus. And he was sent to conduct diplomacy in the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So he went to Jerusalem, I think it was in the 1140s, to negotiate with the King of Jerusalem. And while he was there, he wanted to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque because, well, he's a Muslim, he wants to pray there, obviously. And at this time, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the headquarters of the Knights Templar. But the Templars have put aside a chapel in their headquarters where Muslim pilgrims can pray. So they permit Usama to come and pray in this chapel, and he begins to pray in the chapel. But then a pilgrim from Western Europe comes charging in and grabs Usama, drags him out of the chapel, and tells him he's got to pray in the Christian fashion. The Templars then intervene, grab the pilgrim and throw him out of the chapel, and apologize to Usama and say that they're very sorry. Please could he continue with his prayers? He won't be interrupted again. But this pilgrim's determined. So Usama then resumes his prayers, but the pilgrim comes charging in again, breaks through the Knights Templar at the door, grabs Usama, and again tries to drag him out of the chapel. And the Templars then grab this man and take him completely away. And they apologize to him. And Usama makes the interesting comment that the Knights Templar, because they are more acculturated to the Middle East, are far less rough than people who have newly arrived from Western Christendom. And he also describes the Knights Templar as his friends. Now, that's a very different kind of story to the one that you hear elsewhere. And if you look at the Templars' conduct in other contexts, in diplomacy, in warfare, yes, they are among the leading warriors of the Crusader states. And their Muslim opponents view them as being the most dangerous adversaries on the battlefield. We have one Muslim writer called Ibn Wazil, who actually describes a group of Muslim warriors who are particularly effective as the Templars of Islam. So you can see he's actually describing his own soldiers and using the Templars as a sort of benchmark for military effectiveness. But we also have Templars who form friendships with Muslim rulers. We even have some who become blood brothers with Muslim rulers. So it's a much more complicated picture than Kingdom of Heaven would have us believe.
A big surprise in the first episode was when you said that not only did the Christian forces not know anything about Islam and Muslims and who they're going to be fighting on this crusade, but they weren't interested at all. If we fast forward to the era of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, what are Christians living there thinking of Islam and Muslims now?
Okay, so one thing they know very well is Islam is a different religion. So at a very, very basic level. And there is some very limited knowledge of some of the basic ideas of Islam, and the quality of that information slightly improves over time.
But not much.
Yeah. There are always, both before the Crusade and after it, there are some Western European intellectuals who are interested in Islam and have a better understanding of it. The Quran gets translated into Latin by a Western intellectual in the 1140s. But outside the intellectual sphere, there's really not much knowledge. There's more knowledge about sort of the aspect of Islamic culture. So Muslims don't eat pork, for example, or things like that. And that, although even then, that's often used as a basis for abuse rather than a sort of basis for understanding. So there's not much knowledge. Although interestingly, they are very interested in the different ethnic groups. So there's a lot of interest in the sources from the Crusaders in Arabs and Turks and Kurds. That's an area of interest that does occur. But overall, I'd say that knowledge of Islam as a religion intellectually increases. But outside of an intellectual perspective, there is some development, but not nearly as much as you might think.
All right, back to the military orders. Some of these become very powerful and rich. Are these orders competing with each other for power and wealth? Or are they just working synergistically the entire time? Like, what's happening there?
Right. So, from a purely financial perspective, the closest modern comparison to the Knights Templar or Knights Hospitaller is a charity. With a charity represents a particular cause. People then make donations to that cause, and the charity does its work. The Knights Templar are very, very similar, but again, from a purely financial perspective, because I'm sure we wouldn't see the Templars' actions as being what we would understand as charitable work today.
Yeah, not really. Yeah.
But they sent emissaries back to Western Europe, and they informed people across the social spectrum, so kings, queens, merchants, artisans, farmers, what they do. They are there to protect Jerusalem. They are there to protect pilgrims going to Jerusalem. And this is considered to be a very worthwhile cause. And so people make donations to them. And many of those donations take the form of land. So estates, fields, houses, in some cases, whole villages or towns or churches. And the Templars don't sell these properties, or they don't often sell them. What they do is they begin to build up a huge inventory of property across Western Europe. And even today, we come across lots of Templar-themed names. I remember flying into Tempelhof Airport in Berlin.
Berlin, yep.
That's based on a Templar estate. That's where the name came from. And in lots of countries, we have names which have the word temple in them. Many, many countries. And so from Spain to the British Isles to Germany and Eastern Europe, the Templars and Hospitallers are given lands. And they gather them together into units called commanderies, so regional areas where they have groups of estates. And they acquire hundreds of these things until it's thought by about the 13th century, the Templars have about 900 estates in Western Europe. And each one is required to supply one third of its income to the Crusader states. And so building that up, it becomes a huge sort of pipeline of income. And these estates also act as recruitment centers. So they will talk to the local knights, the local noble families, and encourage their children to join the Templars. They'll then go to their local commandery, become a Knights Templar, and then be sent all the way to distant Jerusalem. So that's the basis of their wealth. It's a massive network of estates in Western Europe that send troops and money to the Crusader states. That's why they got wealthy. But there are challenges here too. The first challenge is that they become so wealthy that they become a threat to the King of Jerusalem and the other Crusader states. They've got so much money that they become a major challenge. And so you actually have kings of Jerusalem complaining about the Templars because the Templars are doing their own policy. They're ignoring what the king wants. They become quite reckless in that regard. And so in 1173, for example, a Muslim community called the Nizaris, known to many modern audiences as the Assassins, they open negotiations with the King of Jerusalem over a treaty, an alliance. But the Templars don't want this treaty. So they kill the Assassins' envoys. And that obviously enrages the king, but it's an example of the Templars acting as overmighty subjects. They're acting too powerful for themselves.
It's kind of darkly ironic that they were championed for fighting the devil spiritually. And then in the end, I believe they were accused of worshipping the devil, right, by the French king and the Pope when they wanted to get rid of them.
Yes. So when ultimately the Crusader states collapse, and they collapse at the end of the 13th century. So Antioch goes in 1268, Tripoli goes in 1289, Jerusalem goes in 1291, Edessa goes a long time before that. And then the Crusader states have finished. The Crusaders and therefore the Templars have obviously failed. At the same time, we have a very ambitious King of France who wants to wage wars against the nasty old English. And he is badly in debt to millions of livres. He needs lots of money. And so on one hand, you have huge Templar estates in the Kingdom of France, extraordinarily valuable. But these Templar estates now, they can send money to Cyprus, but the Templars have obviously failed. But they're very, very wealthy, and the King of France needs money. So you have a discredited Templar order and a King of France in need of a great deal of cash. Now, the king can't just take their money, because the Templars are an institution of the church. That would be outrageous. But he can accuse them of heresy. And so it's not clear if King Philip of France actually believed his own accusations, but he accuses the Templars of heresy and then takes all their money.
Okay, if we can rewind the timeline a bit back again to the era of Saladin. So after the First Crusade, the Sultan of Egypt, he will famously reconquer Jerusalem. I believe it's in 1187, was it?
Correct, yes.
Although, like we said, a lot of these Crusader states will hang on for another 100 years or so. So these guys are not completely out of the picture just yet. Many Crusades try to recapture Jerusalem afterwards, although I believe all of them ultimately fail, right? How come European powers never kind of manage to muster another successful crusade?
Okay, so, yes, Saladin assembles a huge empire in the 1170s and early 1180s, and with that empire, he is able to defeat the Kingdom of Jerusalem at the Battle of Hattin in July 1187, and then reconquer Jerusalem soon afterwards. And this then brings about the collapse of the Kingdom of Jerusalem and massive territorial losses for the northern Crusader states. But then this then triggers the next major crusade, which is the Third Crusade, led by people like Emperor Frederick I of Germany, Philip II of France, and Richard I of England.
And so these are not like dukes anymore. These are actual kings who are going on a crusade.
The Third Crusade is massive.
Right.
And these armies arrive in the late 1180s, and then there's a substantial war that lasts until a peace treaty in 1192. And the Third Crusade fights Saladin over and over again. It wins many of the battles against Saladin, but it doesn't reconquer Jerusalem. But it does reconquer many of the big ports along the coast of the Middle East. And those ports are the economic backbone of the region. So by reconquering many of those ports, that then creates a basis for the survival of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So the Kingdom of Jerusalem survives without Jerusalem for almost a century. Later crusades are also sent to try and rebuild the Crusader states and to reconquer Jerusalem. The Fourth Crusade swings wildly off course and sacks Constantinople, but that's a different story.
Okay.
The Fifth Crusade tries to conquer Egypt before conquering Jerusalem, but it's massively defeated. The Crusade of Emperor Frederick II of Germany, it successfully negotiates the return of Jerusalem in 1229. And for about, let's see, it's 15 years, Jerusalem is restored to the Kingdom of Jerusalem, although it's lost in 1244. Then you have, in the meantime, you have the Sixth Crusade, which doesn't achieve very much. Seventh Crusade, which is defeated by Saladin's descendants. So there are lots of crusades trying to rebuild the Kingdom of Jerusalem or to reconquer Jerusalem itself. One briefly succeeds, but no, the picture in the long term is one of substantial defeat for the crusaders and, by contrast, victory for particularly the sultans of Egypt, who are very effective at defeating crusaders.
One of the more unsettling chapters that I stumbled on when reading a little bit about the Crusades was the so-called Children's Crusade, which during which apparently a bunch of peasant kids got whipped up into a religious frenzy and became convinced they will reconquer the Holy Lands, only to end up, I believe, being kidnapped and sold as slaves across the Mediterranean. Was that a real event? And if yes, what do we know about what actually happened?
Okay, so it's called the Children's Crusade, although technically it wasn't a crusade. To be a crusade, really, it has to be licensed by the Pope, but this one wasn't. But there was a mass movement of people, not just children, although there were children involved, who gathered together and they wanted to reconquer Jerusalem. And so there's tens of thousands of people gather and they march to the southern European ports where they plan to take ship for the Middle East.
And they're being led by who?
They're being led by various different popular leaders. There's a bit of debate over exactly their identity or indeed their age. But they're viewed as being a problem by local landowners and rulers who don't want the disruption caused by all these children. But ultimately, the crusade gets nowhere because it reaches southern Italy. It's got nowhere to go, no way of affording shipping to the Middle East.
Because you have to pay for shipping. Nobody's just going to take you across for free. Yeah.
So the crusade breaks up. Some of the children sort of disappear into the cities of northern Italy. And there are some rumors that some children were taken captive by Italian merchants and then sold as enslaved people. So from a military perspective, the Children's Crusade is a non-event, but it does show just how much interest and commitment there is in the idea of reconquering Jerusalem, and not just among nobles and aristocrats, but among the general populace as well.
And when did that happen?
1212.
I see. So it was a real event, because sometimes when I was reading about it online, some people said that didn't actually happen.
That's a real event.
Because it's not... Okay.
Right. Although, it's a real event, although, again, it wasn't a formal crusade. And just to make life even more complicated, none of the crusades that I've described, not the first crusade, the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, none of them were described as crusades by people at the time. They were called the Journey to Jerusalem. They were called pilgrimages. But the concept of a crusade is an invention of modern historians. It's not actually something people said at the time. They did describe crusaders with the Latin term crucignatus, which means someone marked by the sign of the cross. But even that didn't really emerge until the 13th century. Before that, what we would call crusaders were called pilgrims, or just referred to by their sort of their ethnic group as being Franks or French, essentially, or Italians, that sort of thing.
But these journeys to Jerusalem were sanctioned by the Pope as a military expedition.
Yeah. What they had, which makes them distinctive, is they were sanctioned by the papacy, and the people who conducted them were granted what are called indulgences. And an indulgence goes like this. A knight wants to cleanse himself of a lifetime of waging war against neighboring families for his lord. So he takes a crusading vow. And what he has to do after that crusading vow is to go to his local priest and to confess all his sins. If he confesses all his sins, normally that crusader would then have to perform a penance. So an act to show he's sorry for what he's done. But a crusading indulgence basically means by going on crusade, that penance is entirely removed. So you perform no penance. Doesn't matter what you've done. Killed people, slaughtered towns, stolen from churches, doesn't matter. As long as you confess the sins, the stain of that sin will be wiped clean. And I should point out, it's not just knights. It's knights, merchants, women go on crusade from across the social spectrum. Anyone can take a crusading vow, and provided they take the vow as part of a formal expedition, they get that indulgence that wipes clean the spiritual stain of everything they've ever done wrong.
Were there some women that went along with the crusades on these
journeys? Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, lots of female participants. Some went as part of family groups. So perhaps they went with their brother or with their husband. Some went to conduct their trade. So we hear about sort of female merchants or female women there to conduct sort of, we have female washerwomen who are there to sort of conduct their trade as a washerwoman with the crusaders. There are also prostitutes who accompany the crusaders, although the church is very hostile to their participation. I don't think they take crusading vows, but they do participate in the crusading ventures. And we even have female aristocrats. So Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine, the Queen of France, accompanied her husband, Louis VII of France, on crusade. And Duchess Ida of Austria even led a crusading contingent herself. So she was a crusade commander. So there are lots of these, lots of examples of women going on crusade. And in fact, when Saladin besieged Jerusalem, we have a very interesting account of the siege written by someone called Margaret of Beverley, who's from the English county of Yorkshire. And she went on pilgrimage to Jerusalem and happened to be in the city when Saladin laid siege. And she helped the defenders of the city. She put a saucepan on her head as a helmet and brought water to the defenders as they tried to protect the walls against attack. So we have examples of female pilgrims as well as female crusaders.
By the way, I just thought of this. There were some crusades that were conducted within Europe against some heretic groups, weren't they?
Yeah, so there are lots of crusades. I mean, the crusades to the Middle East are the famous ones.
Yeah.
But in fact, within a few years of the launch of the first crusade, the papacy begins to launch crusades against other opponents. And so in 1107, the papacy launches a crusade against the Byzantine Empire, fellow Christians. A few decades after that, the papacy launches crusades in Spain against the Muslim territories in Iberia. Very quickly, there are crusades launched in the Baltic region against the pagan peoples such as the Wends in what today would be modern-day northern Poland. There are anti-heresy crusades in southern France against the Albigensian heretics. There are crusades in northern Germany against the Stedingers. There are later on crusades in eastern Europe against the Hussites. So basically the crusade as an idea becomes a papal weapon against all its opponents. And there are even crusades launched against the papacy's political opponents, even if those political opponents are themselves Catholic Christians, not heretics at all. So crusading starts being directed against the Middle East, but very quickly it's used as a general tool of military warfare authorized by the papacy.
During the time of the Crusades, were there any contemporaries who viewed the entire endeavor as an immoral one?
Surprisingly few. There are very, very, very occasional indications of that sort of concern. So, for example, towards the end of the 13th century, there's a Spanish, I'm not quite sure what I have described him, preacher and hermit called Ramon Lull. And he suggests that Knights Templar and Knights Hospitaller should be merged into a new military order called the Order of Science and Chivalry, which should try and achieve conversion to Christianity through conversation and debate.
Like a Socratic method of conversion.
Yeah, he does also leave space for them to conduct warfare as well, but within his argument, he makes the point that this would be a much closer to the example of Jesus than going around fighting people. And again, the rise of the Franciscans to some extent is seen as an alternative method to fighting, although the Franciscans and Dominican friars themselves do take part in anti-heresy activities. And again, that's mixed, but there's surprisingly little criticism of crusading as a concept. There's lots of criticism about crusaders misbehaving. So crusaders who plunder their opponents or who conduct campaigns that haven't been well established. But the basic idea of whether a crusade can be launched, there are voices against it, but they're surprisingly few.
All right. How do the crusader states finally fall? Tell us about the last days of these states.
You'd expect something as dramatic as the fall of the Crusader states to be a sort of an epic confrontation and battle. Actually, it occurred rather differently. By the time you get to sort of the mid to late 13th century, the Middle East is in the process of a massive invasion. Not an invasion from the Crusaders, although they did occur, but the biggest invasion is the invasion of the Mongols. The Mongols are in the process of conquering most of Eurasia. China, Middle East, Central Asia. They repeatedly invade parts of Eastern Europe, ultimately even invading Poland and Hungary. And the Mongols are conquering everywhere. And in the Middle East, the really big fear is the Mongols will complete their conquest of the entire area. And certainly the Mongols do destroy many empires and emirates across the Middle East, including Saladin's empire. Saladin dies in 1193. Saladin dies in the 1190s, but his empire continues until it's destroyed by the Mongols in the 1260s. But one empire in the Middle East does prove capable of resisting and ultimately defeating the Mongols. And that is an empire called the Mamluk Empire in Egypt. And the Mamluks managed to hold the Mongols at a battle called Ain Jalut in 1260, following which they managed to conquer much of Syria, or in fact much of Syria hands itself over to the Mamluks because they want to be able to resist the Mongols. And then the Mamluks substantially defeat the Mongols in 1181. So you've got this major new empire rising, growing in power, based in Egypt, but spreading into Syria in the late 13th century. And this empire's big opponent is the Mongols. Now, in the process of the Mamluk Empire's rise to power, and as it grows in territory not taken from the Crusader states, but taken from other areas of the Middle East, the Mamluks become overwhelmingly powerful because they have to raise massive armies to confront the Mongols, who also have massive armies. But in the gaps between the Mamluks fighting the Mongols, they occupy their armies, taking apart the Crusader states. And so the Crusader states' downfall is rather uneventful. When the Mamluks aren't fighting their main enemy, the Mongols, they almost train their armies, destroying Crusader cities, Crusader towns. There's very few battles because the Mamluk army is so much bigger than the Kingdom of Jerusalem's army that there's no point trying to meet the Mamluks in battle. So the Mamluks destroy one town 1 year, 2 years later, another town, then another town, and then it collapses. And so it's a slow period of disintegration at the hands of the Mamluks, who are actually much more worried about the Mongols.
Why does the willingness to organize new campaigns after that dwindle in Europe?
There is a long-standing willingness to send big crusades into the Middle East, but over time, that begins to shift. So in some parts of Western Christendom, for example, crusading becomes diverted. So in parts of the German Empire and Eastern Europe, increasingly crusading campaigns are conducted along the eastern frontiers of Western Europe. So into areas that today would be areas such as northern and eastern Poland, the Baltic states, or Lithuania, that sort of area. There's a lot of crusading in that area, and that may well have diverted crusaders who might otherwise have gone to the Middle East. The papacy also launches a lot of crusades against its internal opponents, which again will redirect crusaders from other targets. Potential crusaders in Spain continue to wage crusades against Muslims in the Western Mediterranean. So there are various diversions, but also there's a lot of wars in Western Christendom which draw the attention of rulers. So there's a war called the War of Sicilian Vespers, a war over Sicily, fought between the Aragonese and the southern Italians, and to some extent the southern French. The Byzantine Empire is in a long-term process of collapse that also draws warriors who might otherwise have gone elsewhere. And then when you get to the 14th century, you've got the famous Hundred Years' War between the Kingdom of England and the Kingdom of France. There's various wars within Germany, and all of this draws attention away from the Middle East. And then over the top of all of this is the threat of Mongol invasion. Because in 1241, the Mongols invaded Hungary and Poland. And particularly in Hungary, but also in Poland, there was enormous devastation. And there is a perpetual fear, perhaps the Mongols will come back, as people are very, very alive to the danger of a new Mongol major offensive. In fact, no massive Mongol offensive really took place, but they don't know that.
Fancy that, you mentioning the Mongols, because I hope we're going to be able to talk about them in one of the next episodes of this podcast. But before I let you go, Professor, in the popular imagination, what's the thing that we get most wrong about the Crusades?
The Crusades are thought to be simple. When I talk to people about the Crusades, perhaps someone I've just met perhaps at a dinner party or an event, and they say, well, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a historian. I study the Crusades. The one thing they're confident about is the Crusades were simple. Christians and Muslims fighting each other. That's it. It's as simple as that. And I'm not going to pretend that there isn't an underlying conflict. There is an underlying conflict between Christians and Muslims. I'm not going to deny that for a moment. But it's a lot more complicated than that. There are lots of occasions when Christians and Muslims work together, often to fight other groups of Christians and Muslims. The causes of war in the Middle East are complex. They can be due to money and trade and commerce, or personal rivalries, or population migrations. And in the 13th century, you've got the Mongols as well. And they get there too as another reason for other forms of conflict, other forms of alliances. During the Crusades, people learn a great deal about each other. And there's a great deal of exchange of ideas and technologies between Christian and Muslim societies. Artisans, architects, mercenaries, falconers, shipbuilders, they crisscross Muslim and Christian territory the whole time, conducting their trade. There's a lot of interaction. And I think perhaps the easiest way for me to explain this is with an example. Do we have time for a quick example?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This example takes place in the early history of the Crusader states. And it goes back to a figure I mentioned before called Usama ibn Munqid. And his hometown of Shaizar in Syria is attacked by an army from the Principality of Antioch, one of the Crusader states. The army of Antioch attacks Shaizar, and the attack goes very badly. And so in the middle of the night, the army of the Principality of Antioch withdraws from the siege, trying to use the hours of darkness to get away from the siege and get back to its friendly territory. But the army of Shaizar realizes what's happening, and so it sets out in pursuit of the army of Antioch, and it begins to try and block the Principality of Antioch's army's escape. So for a short time, it seems as if the army of Antioch is going to get trapped and destroyed. But then one knight steps out from the ranks of his army and manages to hold off the army of Shaizar for long enough to allow his army to escape. That's the first part of the story. The second part of the story occurs a few days later, when this knight, who had enabled the escape of his fellow crusaders, he arrives at the town of Shaizar. He knocks on the door, knocks on the gates, and says that he really admired the way the soldiers of Shaizar fought during their recent battle. Could he come in and train with them for a while? And so Uzama ibn Munkid's family invites him in, shows him their hospitality. They train together for a few days, and then this knight goes home. Now, I offer this story for two reasons. The first part of the story gives you the kind of story that you'd expect: a Crusader army fighting a Muslim army. The second part of the story adds more complexity. There was plenty of scope for friendships and for interaction during this era. Warfare wasn't fought in the modern sense, where the thought of going to sort of socialize with your opponents after a battle, that just doesn't exist. It's a different concept of war. During the Crusades, there are friendships across religious boundaries. There are alliances across religious boundaries. Ideas, technologies, concepts, they get exchanged. They learn more about each other. So yes, there is a religious conflict, but there's a lot of other things going on as well.
Isn't there also this famous story of Richard the Lionheart battling Saladin, and then Saladin loses a horse, and then Richard the Lionheart sends him his own horse during the battle or something?
Yeah, that real? It's not quite clear if that's legendary or not. But even so, the interactions between Richard and his commanders and Saladin and his commanders are very interesting. Saladin and Richard never met. But Richard admired some of Saladin's warriors, and he was very good friends with Saladin's brother. In fact, Richard admired some of his opposing warriors so much that he knighted them, with making them formal knights within his power to do that. Similarly, we have many Muslim writers who describe how Saladin showed compassion for many of the prisoners that he took captive during his wars from Western Europe. And many of these writers describe very positively Richard the Lionheart, or indeed other commanders from the Third Crusade. So even in the Third Crusade, a major climax of warfare between Saladin and the Third Crusade, representing their rival religions, as it were, even then, it's a much more complicated picture than is typically given.
All right, last thing. I don't know why this popped up right now, but wasn't there also like a pretty crazy story of Saint Francis of Assisi, the famous saint, trying to go to Sultan's court and convert him to Christianity or something? Am I way off here, or did that actually happen?
That actually happened.
Okay.
So that is in the Fifth Crusade. And the Fifth Crusade was an attempt to...
There's so many colorful characters. Yeah.
There are. During the Fifth Crusade, there was a massive crusading army that attacked Egypt. The idea being to conquer Egypt and use Egypt's resources to permanently reconquer Jerusalem. And the crusade itself was a military failure. But during the crusade, amidst the fighting, Francis of Assisi walked out of the Christian lines and crossed into the Muslim lines, and then went to the court of the Sultan Al-Kamil, a descendant of Saladin, and attempted to convert him to Christianity. Because St. Francis was the originator of the Franciscan order, which believed, among other things, in trying to convert people to Christianity through preaching and prayer. So he went to the Sultan. He explained why he was there. He had a debate, apparently, with the Sultan's intellectuals. He didn't convert anyone. But then after he'd had this debate with them, he went back to the Crusading army, and that was the end of his journey. But you're right, it's astonishing. But again, it challenges us to rethink modern ideas of warfare. When we fight battles today, we are used to the idea that armies fight battle in quite a sort of absolute sense. You're not friends with your opponent. You don't talk to your opponent. You just fight them and try and beat them. Totally different in the medieval period. Wars take much longer, and warriors have plenty of space for admiration for their opponents, being friends with their opponent. They still fight, although even then they make alliances. But in some ways, it's a little bit more like a sort of a contact sport. There is plenty of room for friendship and socialization. We even have examples of armies fighting each other, and then after the battle, them having a feast together afterwards. That's rare, to be fair, but it can happen. It's a very different way of approaching warfare, and very different to modern day concepts of warfare.
Oh, absolute delight, these two episodes, Professor Morton. Thank you so much for your time. Do you have any sort of social media or websites, anything you would like to share? Where can people follow your work?
Yeah, sure. So you can find me on Twitter or X. Just type in my name, we'll find me there. I'm also on, Blue Sky and on Instagram. You can find my books listed in these places. And I've also got a YouTube channel, the handle for which is @MedievalNearEast. And there's various videos there. Not particularly good quality, I'm afraid, but if you want to find out more about my stuff on the history of the Crusades, you'll find it there. So,
appreciate it. Thanks again, Professor.
Thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you can, all these tedious marketing tutorials instruct that I have to say this, so I'm saying it. Also, if you'd like to do support me on Patreon, this is a one-person podcast. I do everything by my little old self. There's no team behind me whatsoever. It's a tragic state of affairs, I know. But you can help. Please hop on Patreon and find Smart Cookies there. And then last but certainly not least, I have to thank my existing patrons, Tovarishin, Tovarishitsa. You are the champions of my heart. You are the heart of this podcast as well. Without you, there will be no Smart Cookies, which makes you producers of this show. So eternal thanks to Matias Opančić, Dejan Žulnir, Darej, Rok Tržan, Saša Vipotnik, Neven Cvijanović, Juš Premrov, Nejcir, Goran Ivašić, Anže Sever, Aule, Marin Ferrara, Aljaž Mahar, Štrole, Ajda, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronica, and Taichi. Thanks again, you legends. The community is growing, which makes me super happy. Thanks again.